Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters. A woman-owned coffee shop dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. Offering teas and signature drinks like the Hilltopper. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
One of the things you'll notice about working with spelt is that it comes together immediately, much more quickly than wheat does.
Our guest today is Eric Shedler of Muddy Fork Bakery, and he's teaching us how to make pita bread using his stone ground spelt flour. And Harvest Public Media has a report on a worker shortage for the meatpacking industry due to changes in immigration policies. That's all coming up in the next half hour on Earth Eats. Alex Chambers is back with the news. Hey, Alex, what have you got today?
Hi, Kate. Things have been rough in farm country. Among other things, farmers hit by the trade war are still waiting for money the USDA promised them. And a federal jury issued a verdict in a big case about Roundup, the herbicide Monsanto developed. Last August, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said it would purchase over $1 billion worth of food from farmers to offset the Trump administration's trade sanctions. That didn't happen. According to the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, the USDA only purchased 11% of what it promised. The agency bought about $140 million worth of domestic meat, rice, fruit, vegetables, and nuts between the end of October and early February. Pork products accounted for more than 38.5 million pounds of those purchases. The purchases were part of a relief package announced in August to offset millions of dollars in lost markets due to the tariffs. Much of the purchased food ends up going to food banks, school lunch programs, programs for the elderly, or food assistance to Indian reservations. The U.S. imposed 25% tariffs on imported raw materials like steel and aluminum, and China retaliated with tariffs on American agricultural exports, especially soybeans. A new trade deal between the U.S. and China is on the table, but a resolution isn't expected until at least April. The USDA said in February that U.S. soybean exports are down $2 billion due to the trade war. A federal jury in San Francisco has unanimously decided that Bayer AG's weed killer Roundup caused a California resident to develop cancer. Edwin Hardiman alleged in his suit that using the herbicide over 3 decades on his properties caused him to develop non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a cancer that affects the immune system. His lawsuit is the first federal court case against Bayer's Roundup and could predict the outcome of hundreds of cases that the company faces for similar claims. Bayer bought St. Louis-based Monsanto, maker of Roundup, last year. The second phase of the trial, to weigh liability and damages, will begin Wednesday. Hardiman's lawyers accused the company of manipulating public opinion and undermining people who raise concerns about the issue. Bayer has denied its products cause cancer. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, a part of the World Health Organization, reported in 2015 that the chemical likely causes cancer. However, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released an assessment in 2017 that concluded that glyphosate, the key ingredient in Roundup, is not carcinogenic. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Harvest Public Media's Eli Chen for those stories.
Thanks, Alex. It's good to have you back.
Glad to be here, Kate.
Work at a meatpacking plant is physically demanding and dangerous, but it's where many refugees find employment after relocating to the United States. But Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports that companies are finding it hard to hire enough workers due to the Trump administration's refugee policies.
The JBS plant in Greeley, Colorado is massive, processing thousands of cattle a day. More than 3,000 people work here, and many are refugees, like Abul Basar.
How are you?
I met Basar at his apartment, along with his wife and two young children. He tells me he was violently persecuted in his former country of Burma, also known as Myanmar. He fled and spent 5 years running from country to country.
So this time is a very difficult times. I don't have work over there, just eating, sleeping, that's it.
He was finally resettled in Greeley in 2017, and his case manager got him the job at JBS.
It's a very hard job. It's a very difficult job, yes, very difficult. It's not easy.
But it's one of the few jobs that requires little to no English and pays a starting salary of about $15 an hour. That's why, according to a study by the Fiscal Policy Institute, meatpacking has the fifth highest concentration of refugee workers, behind taxi and truck drivers.
I mean, refugees have been very good employees and are very good employees within the industry.
Eric Mittenthal is with the North American Meat Institute, which represents the meatpacking industry. He says plants are struggling to find enough workers due to low unemployment levels, but also because there's fewer refugees. Under the Trump administration, just 33,000 refugees were resettled here in 2017, the lowest number in two decades.
Well, I think as those general policies impact the overall labor market, then yeah, there's a tie there.
Mittenthal says the worker shortage means plants may have to shut down a processing line and can't meet production goals. Companies like JBS, which advertise hundreds of entry-level positions at its 58 plants around the country, are trying to attract more workers with free English classes, sign-on bonuses, and higher wages.
The economy has picked up. It's very different from what it was 10 years ago. And that means that all of a sudden, employers want to do a lot of hiring.
Chris Tilley, a labor economist at the University of California, Los Angeles, says there's a labor shortage across all industries. And he says President Trump's policy to limit refugee arrivals ignores the need for more workers.
The policy now is less a pragmatic one and more an ideological one. In some ways, making a point rather than serving a purpose in terms of how the country works.
It's also likely having an adverse impact on meatpacking, which Tilley calls jobs of last resort. The Department of Labor says the rate of injury for meatpackers is 2.5 times higher than the national average. Abul Basar says he spent more than a year working on the JBS production line, where he used a large electric knife to disembowel cow carcasses. After a few months, his hands began to hurt.
Show me what it is that happens. It gets stuck like that?
He tries to straighten the fingers on his right hand, but his ring finger stays bent.
It's locked, my fingers. Yeah, it doesn't work.
The interpreter says it happened from making the same repetitive motion day after day. Despite his injury, Basar says working at JBS is the best option for supporting himself and his family.
He has to go to JBS because it is the easier one to get a job for non-English speaker.
The day after I visited Basar at his apartment, we met up with the interpreter at a doctor's office in Greeley. Basar is here to see a hand specialist who will determine if he needs surgery.
I want to check in my finger.
After a 20-minute appointment, Basar returned to the waiting room with good news.
Doctor says it's okay.
Physical therapy and a temporary break from his job on the processing line have helped. Again, Basar's interpreter.
Much better than before, so no need to have a surgery.
Basar is visibly relieved by the news as we say our goodbyes. It was time for him to get ready for his 3 p.m. shift at the JBS plant. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Hear more from this reporting collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. If you're a regular customer at the Bloomington Farmers Market or the Winter Market, you're probably familiar with Muddy Fork Bakery. They're the ones with all the beautifully shaped loaves of bread for sale. The flaky croissants, buttery hot pretzels, and in the summertime, fresh baked pizza, including breakfast pizza, with bacon and egg toppings. They're in their 10th year of business, and they've been featured on Earth Eats before. I recently had the chance to visit with Eric Shedler out at Muddy Fork Bakery, at their commercial kitchen on their property located on a country road a few miles east of town.
Today we're going to make some spelt pita. You can make pita with all kinds of flour. You're probably typically think of mostly white flour in a pita, but if you are interested in whole grains, pita is a great way to try out using spelt. Spelt can be a little trickier to work with than wheat. Spelt is a wheat family grain. It's an ancient grain, and it has a little bit of a different dough quality to it that actually lends itself really nicely to being used in pita, pizza dough, flatbreads, because it has a great ability to stretch. It just stretches really easily without ripping. So it makes it easy to stretch things out like pita and pizza dough. It also has a quality in the finished bread or flatbread where it's a very soft, sort of spongy texture, which I think is great for pita. So we're going to make whole grain spelt pitas today.
Okay, we're going to pause here for a quick tour through a few of the wheat types that Muddy Fork uses in their weekly baking.
So I have three different kinds of wheat here. I have Turkey red wheat, which is an heirloom wheat from the 19th century that was brought to Kansas by Mennonites from immigrating from the Ukraine. And at one time, it was the most popular wheat, most widely grown wheat in the U.S. It almost disappeared and sort of having a revival among bakers. So that's the Turkey red wheat is the wheat that we use in our whole wheat breads. And it looks like a typical hard red wheat. Turkey red is a winter wheat. As a hard red wheat, it's got sort of small reddish brownish looking grains. And when we compare that with the ancient grains, those are quite a bit larger. The spelt is a similar color to the wheat red wheats. It's got that reddish brownish color, but it's a lot softer than the turkey red wheat. So we can take a grain and that's the turkey red. It goes crunch. And if you take a grain of spelt, it's a lot easier to chew, even though it's bigger. And that makes it unique because among modern wheats, the soft wheats are lower in protein than the hard wheats, and they are softer to chew, which is why they're called soft wheats. But the spelt is actually a high protein grain, but it's got a soft texture to it. It has its own distinct lineage because it's an ancient grain. And it has, as we've discussed, it has a different quality to the gluten that makes the dough feel different and behave differently. Now we get to the kamut, which is the biggest grain, and it's golden in color. It's also golden all the way through, whereas the spelt and the red wheat are only red on the bran, but once you cut them open, they're white inside. Mm-hmm. This is gold all the way through. And it's related to semolina, which also has that quality of being golden all the way through. The kamut is also very high in protein and iron too, I think. And it's really hard, super hard.
Was that your tooth or the grain?
I'm not sure. Let me figure out.
So now back to the spelt pita dough.
And this is freshly milled spelt off of our stone mill, which if you like our Muddy Fork flour, you can find it at Blooming Foods. If you're into making bread, you may have a little tabletop grain mill at home and you can mill your own spelt. All right, so we're going to start with water and yeast. This recipe is going to make 6 4-ounce pitas. And I only bake bread doughs by mix and make bread by weight, which is very typical in bakeries. It's not as typical in the U.S. for home cooks to use a scale, but it's easier and more precise than measuring. Especially when you get to big quantities, you got to measure 20, 50 cups of flour would be ridiculous. So we weigh everything. So we're going to get 315 grams of water. And then we'll put the yeast in the water for just a minute to let it dissolve. Okay, so we want 1.5 grams of yeast. There's a simple rule about weight conversions with dry yeast, and that is 1/4 teaspoon is about 1 gram. Our tablespoon is about 10 to 12 grams. So for 1.5 grams, we're going to do 1/4 teaspoon, which is 1 gram, and then 1/2 of that 1/4 teaspoon. I'm impatiently whisking the yeast to get it dissolve a little faster. Yeast is dissolved. Now we're going to add the other two ingredients, which is the spelt flour and the salt. We want 375 grams of spelt. So spelt's pretty thirsty flour, and you can see there's only a little bit more flour than water in this dough. we can get into baker's math, but the basic idea of how professional bakers describe their recipes is by percentages so that it can be scaled to any particular amounts. So in this recipe, if you count flour as 100 parts, then the water is 84 parts to that. So we would say this dough has 84% hydration. Everything is measured against the flour. Flour always counts as 100%. And the salt. 6 grams of salt, which is about a teaspoon and a third. Let's see how close that is. I'm using a teaspoon and the scale at the same time. I think closer to a teaspoon and a quarter. Get yourself a spoon and stir it up. If you've made bread dough from wheat flours before, then one of the things you'll notice about working with spelt is that it comes together immediately, much more quickly than wheat does. Mm-hmm. It just has this, the gluten has a different quality to it where it just becomes cohesive right away. And then it becomes very extensible as it ferments. And when I say extensible, I mean that the quality of stretching out, flattening out. If you were to take a ball of spelt dough and a ball of wheat dough and put them on the table, the spelt, you'd like watch it spread out before your eyes in a way that the wheat doesn't. And I did what I could with my mixing spoon, and now I'm sticking my hands in here to incorporate this flour.
It doesn't look that sticky.
It's wet, but it's not that sticky.
He's basically pulling a piece of the dough over the top and kind of pushing it in and spinning the bowl around as he does so.
Yeah, so I like to knead and mix the dough in the bowl rather than on the table, which is sort of a more old-fashioned way to knead your dough, because then you keep adding more and more flour as you're working it on the table. All right, that's it. That's our spelt pita dough. We're just going to set it over on the other side of the room and let it sit for a few hours. We'll come back and give it a few folds during that time, which helps build strength in the dough. And that looks really the same as my mixing technique, where I'm taking a little piece of dough from the edge of the bowl, pushing it down in the middle, spinning the bowl a little bit, pulling another piece. And when I talk about folding dough, we're just going to go around the whole circumference once or twice, and that's a fold.
So the dough has been mixed. Now it needs to ferment. When we come back, we'll divide the dough and get it ready to shape for the pitas. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent providing customized financial services for individuals, businesses, and disabled adults, including tax planning, bill paying, and estate services. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Kate Young, this is Earth Eats, and we're back with Eric Shedler of Muddy Fork Bakery. We're making pita bread today using Muddy Fork's freshly ground spelt flour.
Here we have pita dough, which has been going for a few hours. It's very puffy.
Bubbly.
It has a nice, grainy, fermenty smell to it. It's a little sticky looking. I'll put some flour on the table and pull it out with my bowl scraper. Maybe a little heavier on the flour than some of the other ones because it's a wetter dough. And we are going to cut this into 4-ounce pieces for our pitas. I want to just make sure it's not stuck to the table, so I'm going to slide it around on some flour, let it pick up a little bit of that on the bottom side. and then I'll cut with my bench scraper.
If you're not familiar with a bench scraper, it's an essential tool for many bakers. It's basically a wide, flat blade, a rectangle with a handle running the length of one side of the rectangle, and it's not a terribly sharp blade. It's less like a knife and more like a metal spatula, and it's great for cutting dough, scraping your work surface, and moving pieces of dough around on your table or countertop. It's also sometimes called a bench knife. Eric is using it to divide the dough.
Got our six little balls there. And now we're going to, the six little lumps. Now we're going to make them into balls, and we're going to make them as tight as we can. And the more evenly tight you can make the balls, the more likely it is that they'll puff up the way you want them to. So we're going to use a little flour, and we're going to use the same kind of motion we've used before where we pull the dough from the outside to the middle, but now it's on the tabletop instead of in the bowl. And when you get to the end, there's this tightening motion you can do by pushing the seam against the table and rotating and sort of tugging that dough up and inside. If you did this all day, you'd do one with each hand. You want to get a little traction with your dough on the table. So it's the sound of the dough sliding on the table.
This can be difficult to explain without seeing it, but he's basically holding the small piece of dough in his hand and pushing it slightly against the table while rotating the ball. He's tucking the bottom of the dough in and under and creating a nice taut surface across the top of the dough ball.
Running out of flour, so I put a little more down here.
It takes some practice to get this part down.
All right, there we got six nice little round balls of spelt dough to make pitas.
Normally, Eric would bake the pitas in their brick oven in the bakery,
which is 7.5 feet deep and 5 feet wide, and it's a little bit cool right now because we have a weekly heating and baking cycle, and the oven just retains heat for the whole week. When we're finished heating it on Friday night, it's about 670, and at this point on a Tuesday in the middle of the day, it's at 365.
And that's too cool for our pita baking. So we took the dough on a short walk up the hill to the house where Eric and his family live. We'll bake the pitas in Eric's regular home oven. You might hear his youngest daughter, Ruth, in the background.
So we've got our balls of dough that have been resting for, 30, 40 minutes. And I'm just taking them up off the wooden board, or if you might just have them sitting on your table. And put quite a bit of flour on them because you're going to roll them thin and you'll use up that flour quickly. And I start rolling with a rolling pin, and I'm rotating frequently so that I can try to keep the shape nice and round. Of course, if you have ovals, no problem. I'm just used to making things look round. And we want them to be about 6 to 8 inches across, I think.
And those don't seem to be springing back that much.
No, and part of that is the spelt, and because the spelt has that extensibility to it, where it will stretch easily. And the rest, they had a nice rest after rounding them. If you try to roll them right away, they definitely would. Okay, we've got two pitas ready to go here.
After rolling out the pitas, he's placed them on what's called a pizza peel. It's one of those large wooden paddle-shaped tools with a long handle. It makes it a lot easier to slide things like pizza or pita bread into a hot oven.
I've preheated some fire bricks in the oven, and you can use a pizza stone the same way. I just happen to have fire bricks lying around from having built a brick oven. And I preheated them at about 500, and now I've turned the oven down to 450. Emulates a brick oven, because in our wood-fired oven, the bricks are the heat source. So the air is always a little cooler than the bricks.
Oh.
So here we go, sliding them on, closing the door.
And then on the peel, you had a little bit of rice flour, yes. But you could use cornmeal or something, or you can recommend?
I really like rice flour on a peel. I think it's more effective than regular flour or cornmeal. And it also burns at a higher temperature than cornmeal and wheat.
So you don't get that smoky.
You don't get as much. Depends how hot your oven is. Our bread oven is about 670 when we start baking bread on Friday nights, so...
Making pita is a fun thing to do with kids, or really with anyone who hasn't lost their sense of wonder. After a few minutes in the hot oven, they begin to puff up as the signature pocket fills with steam. With an oven light and a window, it happens right before your eyes, like a time-lapse video. But it's real time. It's quite magical.
All right, I'm going to crack open the door. And it looks like they started to inflate, turning into little balloons in there. So we're going to just make sure the bottoms get a little bit brown, which they're not yet, and then we'll flip them over.
This is a small flatbread, so it doesn't take long.
All right, I'm going to flip these pitas over. I think it's easier with a spatula than using the peel. There we go. I popped them too.
So now they're deflating.
As always, we'll have this recipe available on our website, eartheats.org.
All right, so the first two pitas are done. We're taking them out, and I like to cool them on a plate with a towel. And so you make a stack of pitas, and as you're taking them out and making the stack bigger in between each batch, you bring the towel over it to cover it so that they stay moist and warm and soft.
And that is how you make pita. Each batch only takes a few minutes to bake. You can make a whole stack of them for dinner, and the extras keep nicely in a plastic bag for lunch the next day. Next week, we'll share a recipe for what to put inside your pita pockets. Eric will show us how easy it is to make your own falafel. That's right, falafel, from scratch. It's a lot simpler than it sounds. So be sure to join us next time with Eric Shedler from Muddy Fork Bakery. Eric will be sharing more baking recipes with us in the coming weeks, including challah, pretzels, and pizza. Subscribe to our podcast and you'll never miss an episode. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's all we have time for today. I'm Kate Young, and thanks for listening to Earth Eats. And thanks to everyone who helps with the show, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Renee Reed, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Eric Shedler and everyone at Muddy Fork Bakery. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop committed to sustainable practices and organic, ethically sourced coffee from small-scale farmers, featuring handmade quiche, scones, and baked goods. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And Bill Brown at Griffey Creek Studio, architectural design and consulting for residential, commercial, and community projects. Sustainable, energy positive, and resilient design for a rapidly changing world. Bill at griffeycreek.studio.